of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing the conversations about the cultures of consciousness. I was just reading an article in the New York Times about the cancellation of the Google Glass program, which I have to say I felt rather good about. But it stirred up some of my questions about the future, ideas of the future, ideas of enhanced cognition, of melding with machines. And I had originally interpreted the sort of failure of the product as kind of a triumph for those of us who feel that the potential of technology is going often in rather absurd and dangerous directions, wrapped up in the guise of some sort of liberatory, culturally cool, or even necessary technology, a kind of resistance, I would say, that many of us feel towards being yanked into a particular corporation's idea of what the future should consist of. But I also recognize that in my, you know, complex set of feelings around Google Glass, there was also the sort of science fictional delight in the product, and even to some degree a science fictional delight in the wooziness that it introduced. The first time I ran into somebody who was actually wearing glass, there was a definite sort of a sense of fear and revulsion. And I really like working with those feelings. I want to insist that I'm not convinced that any of my feelings of disgust or revulsion that arise vis-a-vis technology or anything else has to do with some natural understanding of the truth of the matter, or the idea that these feelings are some sort of guide to a moral picture of the world. I think they are that for some reasons, and that they should be paid attention to. But often in the debate around new technologies, and indeed in many of the transhumanist tendencies in our culture and in our technology that we'll be talking about today with authors Are You Serious? And Jay Cornell, who have just put out a great disinformation encyclopedia of transhumanism and the singularity. But for me, a lot of the most interesting dimensions of this debate have to do with emotions rather than with reasons, where it strikes me that many of the people who are very resistant to transhumanist possibilities are often coming from a kind of gut level. They feel it's sort of, there's something wrong, there's something dangerous, there's something gross, there's something icky, there's something terrifying about these technologies and the sort of malleability of human potential that strikes many people as kind of terrifying. And then on the other end, I often find that a lot of people who are interested or fascinated or obsessed with these possibilities and these devices also have to my mind, a somewhat peculiar affective response, where there's a kind of glee, a kind of joy in transgressing or in escaping what is seen to be these old, analog, embodied, human, animal, biological aesthetics or sensibilities or ways of being in the world. And there's a kind of a real strong hunger to exceed these, or at least to only pick and choose exactly those elements of the human experience, usually ones having to do with pleasure, and leaving everything else in aside, including all of these incredibly rich, marvelous associations and complexes of meaning that surround old school human verities like death and aging and confusion and the mixture of reason and emotions that we're trying to navigate. So there's also a weird kind of emotional thing going on. So what I have been doing when approaching these questions about all of these technologies that are coming our way, that are being embraced by some, demonized by others, hacked by still more, and that one way or another are already part of our lives and are going to be more so, is to kind of always be aware of where the emotions are going on as well, and to not believe that disgust or horror is necessarily an insight into the reality of the thing, but also at the same time to recognize that those are extremely valid reactions emotions, and that they must be sort of navigated as well as a possible sources of insight, but also possible sources of change and of moving forward. So with that in mind, we'll bring on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric. You know,
you
what I thought about as you were saying all that? It's kind of crazy because you could kind of relate everything you said about those emotional reactions to transhumanism to kind of what the transsexual community goes through, right? People have similar emotional reactions to that. And similarly, the transsexuals are all like, you know, well, forget this body. I'm going to transcend whatever God has put limitations upon my sexuality. I'm going to take matters into my own hands, and I'm going to do this. And then equally, many people have some kind of like moralistic emotional response where it seems to me like on that, you know, eccentric, quirky, as you said, level of transsexual or transhuman or trans, anything you want to trans, it's very unemotional. It's just more like, well, I can do this, so why wouldn't I do this? You know, and it's not, it's like that difference of the ones that perform it. It's not, it's like logistical, then other people have emotions towards that.
That's a really interesting connection, and that is a thread in the Encyclopedia of Transhumanism and the Singularity, which I really learned a lot from. I thought I was, you know, sort of up to snuff on the field, as it were, but I really came away with a lot of additional information, and one of them was one of the things that I discovered was precisely the way in which the some issues in transgender thinking really kind of tie in with some transhumanist arguments, and indeed, as you might expect, that there are transsexual transhumans, and that they're very vocal about presenting certain ways and of conceiving a transhuman future, and many of which don't have quite the same, let's say, maybe a kind of masculine engineering geekery, which comes up in so many of these visions, and something a little bit more about the playful possibilities of self-transformation, which are, you know, in some ways they're related discourses, in other ways they're very different. And so I really came away from this book realizing how complex and multidimensional this whole world is.
Yeah.
So with that, let's bring on our guest today, Are You Serious and Jay Cornell. Welcome to the show, guys.
Thanks a lot. Good to hear you.
Hi.
Hey, you there, Jay. Good. Excellent. So yeah, congratulations. You know, it's funny, I was thinking about, you know, the value of the book, because, you know, so many of the things that you write about, you know, human enhancements, neurotechnology, surveillance drones, you know, it's all online. You know, it's all about the internet and finding people through the internet and research papers and, you know, blog posts, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm holding this book. But what I realize is that the book gave me an overview, and that's what's so hard to get doing research online, particularly when you're following some cutting edge world. It's very easy to get into a rabbit hole and to get down into nitty gritty debates and who are the characters in one zone, but it takes a while to get a bigger picture. And so the encyclopedia form that you guys have chosen, where there's short chapters on this myriad of topics, and in addition, there's a mixture between your voices as you're introducing the topic, and then you include quotations from a whole host of other people, many of whom I was happy to see that I knew or knew of, and they add different kind of elements, sometimes, you know, much more intense than your own slightly more skeptical take. And so it's really quite a great one-stop shop for those of us trying to wrap our heads around this issue. So I just wanted to, you know, compliment you on that, and also just to ask you, you know, how do you feel about, what does it say about the fact that you're writing a book about these things that are in some ways so much about the post-book world?
I think, I mean, one of the things is that we made it fun to read. And I mean, you can go online and find a lot of stuff about a lot of these topics, but you don't get a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, some tongue-in-cheek commentary, some irreverence, and some playfulness. And I mean, there are ways to construct little mini narratives that make it more interesting to read, not just for a newcomer, but for somebody who's been around these sorts of ideas for a while, that tends to bring something out about a topic or about a combination of topics that people might not have noticed before. And the one other thing I would add about the nature of the book is, I mean, there's also a lot of linking going on in the book, so that you'll have a topic like a longevity / immortality, and then underneath it you'll have, see also, Aubrey de Grey, caloric restriction, cryonics, the Methuselarity, mind uploading, nutraceuticals, telomeres. So and there are all these links between all these topics. You begin to get a sense of how the idea of transhumanism and the idea of the singularity form a sort of memeplex of technologies and ideas and sciences and in some cases even people and organizations that kind of loosely link together into a way of looking at the world, or in a plurality, really, of ways of looking at the world.
Well, one thing that I would say is that
I think that the digital world has
really emphasized the value of editors and of curation. You know, we're doing something when we assemble a bunch of information in a certain way. And there is sort of a McLuhan-esque paradox to it, in that, you know, we're using dead trees to communicate ideas about the future. But that sort of thing does happen.
Well, I think there's something related here, in that that one of the great offerings you guys bring to this conversation is a sort of way in for people who are neither neo-Luddite nor blazingly transhumanist. I mean, both of those folks would get something out of it as well. But in particular, there's kind of a sort of space around these topics, which are very charged. You know, a lot of these topics are extremely charged, and they're even made charged by the way that a lot of people put them forward. I mean, there's a lot of radicalism in transhumanism, you know, whether the kind of political positions that are sometimes associated with it, like anarcho-capitalism, where there's just this vision of just destroying the state and leaving democracy, and or uploading the mind, and a lot of the people who are interested in these ideas are actually kind of enjoy the extremity of it, which has always been one of the things that I both find appealing and somewhat difficult, because I like extremity and radicalism in kind of cultural envisioning. But at the same time, a lot of these particular ones I also find sort of challenging. And the tone that you have of this kind of irreverence, but at the same time, it's not coming from some reactionary perspective, which is, again, something also you see. I mean, there's so much polarization in our discourse about everything these days. It's so quick. Our media environment encourages that kind of extremity, that it's just a real delight to find that kind of middle way. And I'm just sort of interested how both of you guys have sort of come to your own sort of middle way about these topics. I mean, I know less about how long you've been dealing with this stuff, Jay, but I know that for RU, this has been, you know, a part of your world for a very, very long time, because you can trace transhumanist ideas about cognitive expansion and space migration and robotics back to the 70s, back to Timothy Leary and his sort of 70s turn towards sci-fi futurism. So I know you've been working with these ideas for a long time through Mondo 2000, et cetera. But as, you know, as the decades have gone and you've seen things come and go, what has sort of led to your kind of tone about this, the place that you've find yourself both sympathetically and critically vis-a-vis this sort of memeplex of ideas and technologies?
Well, I mean, as editor of Mondo 2000 in the 90s, and then before that, Reality Hackers and High Frontiers, you know, I've always been in a position of sort of the ringmaster of a bunch of maniacs and freaks. many of whom were very earnest about what they believed, whether that be that some person, you know, psychically made himself travel from New York City to Long Island in 3 minutes and show up in somebody's room. And we had that sort of stuff going on in there. I've always had a certain ability to, almost a reflexive reaction against totalism and against certainty. So I like to bring that bit of uncertainty, that idea that, you know, this could go either way, this could go in any of a number of directions, and I like allowing people to have the space for that. And I think I've always done that as an editor, in that sense that I am corralling in people who are very much true believers in some of these things, but contextualizing them in a way that allows the reader to experience some space for them, for themselves.
Well, for me, I've read science fiction since I was a tiny child, and that has warped my worldview pretty thoroughly. And it's just something I've always been interested in. And some of my my earliest, you know, children's books were things about, you know, what the Apollo program will look like, you know, when it actually happens, from the early 60s. And that gave me a perspective on a lot of things. Plus, I've always been interested in history, and I'm now at the age where I've lived a lot of history. And that's given me a perspective about a lot of things. Also, as you may remember, Eric, I used to work at Gnosis Magazine, which you contributed to at the time. That's where I first encountered your work. And that gave me a lot of perspective about spiritual and religious beliefs and all kinds of beliefs. And so when I add all that up, I can see something like transhumanism, and on the one hand, I'm interested and sympathetic towards the goals. At the same time, I don't think I'm blind to, you know, potential dangers, and something that I wrote about in the book is the long history of the failure of various technological predictions about how, yes, dynamite and machine gun and the airplane are such terrible things that it will end war, or, you know, the telegraph and motion pictures and television are such wonderful things that they will end war. And once you have some knowledge of a lot of these failed predictions, it's hard to take a lot of the cheerleading totally seriously.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because just the other day I was, bouncing around Twitter, and I was sent to an article where someone was talking about how the combination of Facebook and Oculus Rift was the perfect platform for creating the empathy we need to avoid world calamity, because, you know, if you're inside of a virtual reality where you're at a whatever, Pakistani wedding, and then suddenly there's a drone strike and everybody's dead, then of course you're naturally going to start to empathize with these people being real people, and that, you know, we're all together. And it's not only that this is just another sort of a kind of technological hype, is that if you're a historian, you know, if you know anything about the history of media, it's exactly the same argument. It's exactly the same argument as television, as telegraphs even. And so there's a sort of – it's also kind of difficult as you get older. There's a little bit of a sadness. It's like, oh, I kind of almost like to believe that, but I don't. And so it puts you in this kind of strange position when you can see those patterns over time sort of repeating themselves. And yet you started off talking about science fiction – and that reminds us that there is always fiction and fantasy and story in pictures of the future and even the decisions we make about the pictures of the future. So it's a very interesting zone where we kind of have to, you know, move towards the imagination and envision what the consequences of things are. And yet those positive visions are almost inevitably just drawn into a kind of ambiance of hype and distraction that surround all of these very powerful and difficult issues around power, around surveillance, around control, you know, on and on and on. So it's a very strange predicament. So when you guys think about the future and you think about judging these various visions that you see and trying to weight them in terms of value or whatever, what do you rely on? Is it a critical thinking process? Do you have your own specific science fictions that you want to have happen? Are we kind of making this up as we go along, or are there real guideposts you think towards to help us navigate between the hype, the real possibilities, and the fears that we legitimately feel in our guts?
For me, a lot of my response to a lot of discourse in transhumanism and the singularity revolves around the question, what do we actually want? Because you do have a lot of people in these cultures who just seem to have made it their project to have greater quantity, more memory, more information processing, faster information processing, longer lives, more years, and so forth. And, you know, when people start becoming obsessive compulsive about those things, they leave behind not only our embodiment, but sort of, they certainly de-emphasize the question of what do we actually want? You know, where do we want to get with this stuff? And then is that possible? And what should the priorities be? I think ending scarcity should be a greater priority than living 1,000 years. On the other hand, I think that longevity technologies will also be health technologies, and keeping people healthy is right up there with ending scarcity. So try to balance those things. Then, you know, how do we experience the world? We experience the world through our minds, through our brains. So let's not just enhance our minds and brains, but let's make them feel good. Let's give them ways to help the mind and the brain be present, as well as be looking towards the future. So a lot of it, I just follow my instincts, but those are kind of the ways in which I take in transhumanism and then sort of spit out a somewhat different view from a lot of the people who are more obsessed with technology for technology's sake, I think.
Well, for me, I think...
And what about you, Jay?
I think the essential attitude that I bring to it, and it might just be my own personality, is that I have a tendency to always want to take a step back and take a larger view of things. And that sort of makes it hard or impossible for me to become a fanatic about any one thing or any one point of view, because I have a tendency to want to at least understand what the other side is saying and to try and put it in the perspective of history and so on. And so with transhumanism, I like a lot of the ideas. I like a lot of the goals. I also detect a lot of starry-eyed techno-optimism that, as we talked about, has a checkered history of actually happening the way that it was predicted to happen. And then my tenure at Gnosis Magazine gave me a lot of insight into spiritual and religious belief, and it's sort of undeniable to me that there are various secular enthusiasms like transhumanism that seem to be where a lot of nominally non-spiritual and non-religious people put a lot of spiritual and even religious energy, and that immediately sets off my little detectors when I say, and I end up thinking, these people sound a lot like, you know, evangelical Christians talking about the wonders of the heavenly world, I can't shake that connection.
Well, that's interesting.
Yeah,
I mean,
maybe
you guys could talk a little about what you found out about those implications of, like, how the idea of immortality affects individual humans' brains. Like you said, like, how do we figure out what we want? And in terms of dealing with, is that the ideal, is to just have that immortality? Because it seems like throughout history, and if you look at a lot of these cycles, that seems to be the carrot that they dangle in front of the donkey, so to speak, to try to get everybody into it. They just say, well, you live forever and everything will be great. No more wars. Peace is here. So there seems to be that, like, bait that seems to be kind of what any propaganda, whether it's evangelical Christians or, you know, you name it, any kind of entity that uses this heavenly sort of ambrosic, like, you know, lottery winning thing at the end of it to do whatever they want. Do you feel like, did you guys get a sense that through sorting through the propaganda, did that seem to be like a kind of agenda, would you say, to just sort of try to make it about the immortality?
I would say, I mean, on my Steal This Singularity website, I make an allusion to the Woody Guthrie saying, there'll be pie in the sky when you die, which was his critique of religion and the way religion sort of holds people back from seeking more mortal types of answers. And so I sort of twisted that into, there'll be pie in the sky when you don't die. So yes, I mean, there's this quasi-religious offering being made. And from my view, my less, my more dissident side looks at this and says, well, that's one part of the transhumanist thing, is using the promise of heaven as a sort of control mechanism. And then at the same time, I mean, it is a tremendous enticement. I mean, the idea that, you know, nanotechnology can do miraculous things doesn't seem that unfeasible. The idea that artificial intelligence could become super smart and resolve a lot of problems, although perhaps not human behavior, you know, the war thing, the Darwinian thing, but, you know, solve material problems that makes violence, perhaps reduces our impulse towards that. I mean, these things do seem plausible. And then you get into the really far out stuff, like, you know, you can download your brain into another, you know, onto a computer and perhaps become part of a heavenly world in there. And that stuff I find that kind of frightening. It doesn't sound heavenly to me. But I don't know. Jay may have some thoughts on that as well.
Well, I don't. I would question the word agenda, because to me that implies that someone is sort of, you know, that they have that they're sort of manipulating people with sort of a secret goal that they're not talking about. I see it more as simply enthusiasm. You know, people believe what they believe, and they want to share it with people. They want to help people. You know, that happens not just in the technology area, of course, but, you know, in, you know, religious and political areas. And sure, there are people who have secret agendas and are, you know, saying things they don't believe so that they can make people do something that they don't want to say. But a great deal of the energy in all of those areas, I believe, comes from people who sincerely believe that, oh, yes, you know, the revolution will mean that all poor people will be helped or whatever.
Right.
And So yeah. So, but other than that, yeah, there is a lot of that feeling there.
Yeah, I would echo what you said about the use of the word agenda. I don't think that's. I mean, even at the level of the more powerful, well-connected establishment people who are involved in these ideas, like Ray Kurzweil or Peter Diamandis, I think they're just motivated by a sincere desire to get technologies out to people that they think will improve their lives. So, anything I might have said about, still the singularity and this being a kind of offering to behave yourself so that you can get this reward, that's implicit, but it's not something. It's not a grand conspiracy or anything.
Right.
Like
right.
That.
Exactly.
Well, this let's ask a concrete question along these lines, and you mentioned it a couple times in the book. Of course, Ray Kurzweil works for Google, and Google, in many ways, and this is partly why I raised the issue about Google Glass at the beginning. Although obviously, it's a more complicated story in terms of it's really just a beta version, as my PRN engineer reminded me. It's going to be coming back in some newer, better form, undoubtedly. But the whole idea is that part of the reason I brought it up is that Google itself has now become this immensely powerful global corporation that has explicitly in its sort of cultural presentation a kind of transhumanist flavor. And I would love to hear what you guys think about that, and in terms of how much is that just a little icing on the top? How much are they thinking of themselves as a corporation that's going into this very future that all of these various technologists and futurists are kind of envisioning and trying to already kind of make moves? And what that sort of says about where we are, that some of these ideas are no longer merely in, crazy boards of programmer geeks or grinder biohackers, but that they're in the corporate boardrooms of, some of the largest corporations in the planet.
Yeah, I mean, they're funding life extension, and they're funding artificial general intelligence as opposed to artificial intelligence, which is what they already do. But actually trying to create human like intelligences that might match us or exceed us. So, I mean, they're actually on those projects. Then again, so is DARPA. There are a few other ones. And you have to also keep in mind that these aren't their core projects. And a lot of companies and a lot of agencies and so forth throw some money at these exciting projects, and sometimes nothing much happens. I think of the software company out here in Marin. I wish I could remember their name. But in the late 80s, early 90s, they were sponsoring a virtual reality program with Eric Gellickson and Pat Gelband. They were sponsoring Ted Nelson and his project to, link all the world's information together. They were doing all this very extreme, far-out stuff because the person on the company, the hacker there, had, wanted to do these things that would radically change the world. And eventually, they decided they were spending too much money, and all that stuff stopped. And none of it went anywhere. So, I mean, looking at it from the perspective of a lot of these companies, this is something they'd like, but it's not their bottom line.
Oh, I agree.
Well, we're going to have to take a break right now. We got some more questions coming up for you guys. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. Eric Davis and Maja Dayu. We're talking with Are You Serious and Jay Cornell about their new book, The Disinformation Encyclopedia of Transhumanism and the Singularity, i.e. Transcendence. And we'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Dayu and Eric Davis. We're speaking with Are You Serious and Jay Cornell on transcendence and transhumanism today. Are you serious? You got cut off there at the end. Do you remember what you were going to say, or did it float away?
I'm not sure.
I was just going to...
Huh?
Oh, sorry. I was going to comment on Google that technology writer Robert Cringely believes that, you know, the real reason for all of these far out Google X projects is that it keeps Sergey Brin out of Larry Page's hair so that Larry can run the company. And it's like, yeah, Sergey, you explore that. Yeah, internet via balloons. Okay, good idea. Here's money.
Right. That's pretty good. Hey, I wonder if you can, since you guys are both, or at least one of you mentioned how you're big sci-fi fans, I wonder if through your editing all of this material, did any of you get any hits on kind of like a particular sci-fi author or kind of book series that seemed to mirror or make predictions that you felt might be accurate towards the transhumanist material? I mean, that's kind of a big question. Maybe there's not just like a single one or anyone, but I was just curious if there were any kind of, because I always like that when you can find those really crazy parallels and you just kind of get a feeling like it feels kind of prophetic.
Well, we do have actually a section on science fiction in the book, and there are a number of things mentioned in there. I mean, there are always the Philip K. Dick novels that where you're not sure if you're in a real world or you're in a virtual world, and you're not sure if, you know, who's an actual biological person and who's a technologically created sort of person, and you know, has all the extreme surveillance mechanisms that we talk about in the book, and brain implants and all that sort of thing. I mean, there are so many of them. Werner Vinge, who is the person who really first spoke of a technological singularity, is a science fiction writer, and this concept appears in the mid-80s, Marooned in Real Time, and then a book called A Fire Upon the Deep in 1992 kind of plays with the idea of the singularity. And yeah, I mean, you can find pretty much all these concepts in Werner Vinge's stuff across the board. A lot of Charlie Strauss novels deal with a lot of these ideas. Singularity Sky, obviously, it's right there in the title. Cory Doctorow and Charlie Strauss together wrote a sort of satire of transhumanists and singularitarians called The Rapture of the Nerds, which is great. It would be easier probably to try to find science fiction stories that don't deal with some aspect of some of the things we're talking about in the book. I mean, robotic space travel, life extension, intelligence increase. I mean, all these things are present in, or some of these things, or one of these things are present in most science fictional presentations, including films and TV shows and so forth.
Yeah, and you do a good job of covering that stuff in the book as well. I mean, there's a really nice entry on Matrix and a science fiction entry that mentions a number of writers. Another thing I wanted to make sure that we got a discussion of, and probably one of the bigger sort of insights for me that came out of reading your book, was that the association between transhumanism and libertarianism is not quite as tight as, let's say, I had believed. I mean, in many ways, I think, like a lot of at least older people, my first real sense of a kind of cultural political model of transhumanism was with the Extropians in the 1990s, where you had a very kind of a powerful sense of a kind of libertarian politics combined with the expansion of technology and human potential into these increasingly far out regions. So they became kind of fused in my mind as going hand in hand. And yet you say in your book that actually there was a survey taken, and you know, good half of the transhumanists, self-identified transhumanists, were considered themselves to be liberal or left. So I'd love to have you clarify a little bit to me what these relationships are, how intrinsic they are. Is it an American thing? What are the non-libertarian transhumanists? What are their concerns? It seems like that's a really important thing to clarify.
Yeah, well, there's a statement that just came out. I can't remember the title of it. The progressive, a statement for progressive futurists or something like that. I think in the U.S. maybe there's more of a tendency for people to be transhumanist or to be libertarians who are associated with transhumanism, and then in Europe and other places there might be a tendency for them to lean more towards the left. I'll tell you a personal story. I was hired to edit H Plus magazine, which was sort of the way in which I became more closely integrated into the transhuman culture, even though Mondo 2000 used to cover a lot of that sort of stuff. You know, I went to my initial meeting with a couple of the people from the transhumanist organization, Humanity Plus, used to be the World Transhumanist Association, and we're having a pretty pleasant discussion about hiring me to edit the magazine, and a little nervously I said, I've got to tell you guys, you know, I have a bit of a libertarian streak, but I'm sort of a liberal. And they both looked at me and said, me too. I think that the libertarians, the anarcho-capitalists, tend to be loud about it and radical about it. And then sort of the hard left people and the Marxists tend to be loud about it. But a lot of the people in between tend to emphasize the technology or the ideas and simply don't chatter about their politics, and that has perhaps become a hidden aspect of transhumanism, even here in the United States.
I would also say that there's sort of a blind man and the elephant thing going on here, where, you know, different people are interpreting this future thing differently, and partly they're taking a there's a bit of confirmation bias going, I think, and so you have socialists who have been disappointed perhaps by the 20th century failure of socialism, saying, aha, you know, once we have nano assemblers, then we really can, you know, eliminate capitalism. There's also a third string in transhumanist politics that's popped up recently that one could call neo-reactionary. That's not exact. It's not libertarian, really. It's definitely not left-wing. It's a little more of the it's a little more of the, sort of the Nietzschean side of things, and the, you know, the attitude of, you know, we can't let the ignorant masses hold down my future increase of personal power sort of attitude, and I'm not going to name any names about people who are into that sort of thing right now, because I really don't. It's a minefield, because everyone starts throwing around terms like fascist and Nazi, and I don't think that most of these people really are fascists or Nazis, but they can get labeled that way from people at from other points of political, from other points on the political spectrum.
Well, it is interesting in terms of how it reflects the problem of the way in which, how to say this, that how widely diverse people's experience and understanding and comfort with technology are. So you are going to find large groups of people who are just have a basic kind of fear or reticence or at most a kind of science fictional enjoyment, but it's not at all embodied in actual practices. And then you have, you know, these extremely powerful technologies that do have a democratic potential in the sense that they can are more or less available for many people, at least people who are, you know, going to, you know, learn how to engage with them. And so you do get this, it's almost like a kind of technological or technocultural version of the, you know, splintering economic society we have here, where and so I'm kind of curious how you see that. Does the development of these technologies, whether it's, you know, neuro enhancements or health life extension technologies, how much does it seem to be that they are happening in the among the wealthy, and then how much of it seems to be kind of almost against or across particular class lines? I mean, you have an interview in the book with a grinder, with somebody who's doing sort of, you know, down and dirty body enhancement, putting in sensors and magnets into the body and, you know, really like hacking the biology. And he makes a point of like saying this is not about being having tons of resources and being a member of the elite. In fact, it's the opposite. So there is that tendency too, where there's a more kind of radical democratic potential. How do you guys feel that that's working out, at least now, in terms of the laying the class structure over the technocultural enthusiasm?
There's also a big project called Citizen Scientist, in which there's a section on that, and there's also a section on open source, and those two things overlap. And there's also biohacking. So there's a lot of grassroots energy and a lot of grassroots work that takes place. There's also a lot of work that takes place at the level of the universities, some of which, you know, gets sucked up into the corporate model, and some of which becomes distributed. So, you know, I think there's a dynamic where stuff is being democratized, and at the same time, there are large companies that hope to profit from it. But even the large companies that hope to profit from it, usually the way they'll profit from it is by selling lots of units of whatever it is, rather than just, you know, building an eternal life module for Richard Branson and six of his friends to escape Earth and leave the rest of us to suffer. So, I mean, I think there's a trend towards, an intrinsic trend towards this stuff being democratized, both consciously and just by its nature. And then there are a few things where, like, say, organ replacement, some things along those lines, some kinds of medicines that might end up being exclusively for wealthy people. Jay?
Yes, I agree. And I think that it's one of the things that you'll see in history, just sort of economic history, is that, yes, the technological breakthroughs at first are generally going to benefit the rich, the politically connected, you know, the national military, but then they filter down and become less expensive. And that's not necessarily a bad process. The first examples of anything tend to be really expensive. Back in the 70s, you had rich people buying the first digital watches for hundreds or in some cases thousands of dollars. And, you know, for a couple of years, they looked pretty cool. It was like, wow, look, I can press this button and some red lights show up and show me the time digitally. And they looked cool for a few years, but all that money ended up funding the process, which, you know, got us digital watches, which you can now buy for, you know, $2 at the dollar store or whatever. So, I'm kind of okay generally with the rich funding these things and, you know, being the first to try them. I don't want to be the first person to try to upload my brain to a computer or to try enhanced thing like that. I am perfectly happy to let other people go first and see how it works out.
In an ironic turn of events, we used to recruit poor people to be guinea pigs, and now wealthy people might be recruiting themselves to be the guinea pigs for technologies that might actually cause them difficulties before they become safe and available to most or all. I mean, Peter Thiel is taking human growth hormone to extend his life. That could be problematic. It's a good experiment on behalf of all of us.
No, I love that that argument, which I came across, reading your book a couple times. You sort of go through some of the typical criticisms that come up of this stuff, and that this class question, of course, is one of them. And that answer to me also sort of summarizes what's great about your book, where there's a kind of sensible thinking through with an open-hearted character to it that still kind of recognizes the sort of marvels of these opportunities. I mean, it is extraordinary what kind of visions these technologies are pointing us to. And we only have a few minutes left, and I know it's a big topic, but I'd love just to hear on a real kind of basic level, after all the reading and thinking you have about the thing that's part of your title, the singularity, this notion that there's some moment in 10, 20, 30 years where things develop so much that we are no longer actually able to think or understand what's going to happen because of the advancement of artificial intelligence or robotics, or it all kind of comes together in some way that just totally transcends the human capacity to understand what's going on. How do you feel? How is your feeling? Your gut feeling about that? Is it worthwhile to think of it as an event? Is it something that you have a sense of its proximity, or is it more? Has it become more of a myth or a football to bounce around?
I'll quickly say my view.
Shows people what they want.
Yeah, my view is agnostic on a singularity, and I have the intuitive sense that when push comes to shove, even really amazing artificial intelligence that outperforms us in almost every way will still be a tool rather than our mind child exceeding us in the evolutionary process.
Or our tyrant who rules us all and decides whether the human race should become extinct. I don't think that's terribly likely. I do think that, in a way, the singularity is sort of a handy term to summarize a lot of ideas. I think one can argue that it's already happening, and that, just in the last 20 years, computers have remade the economy, and nobody works as a typesetter anymore. Bookstores and record stores are closing. Travel agents have been decimated. And we've got Amazon's warehouses that now have robots scurrying around retrieving items from shelves automatically. So it's already starting.
Yeah, and then for that reason, I think that paying attention to even the most radical views, to my mind, is a good place not only to figure out what my values are, what are the things that I'm interested in, where do I draw the line, what's it worth, where do I put my bets, so to speak, but just to constantly remind ourselves that we are already in this process, and there's a human tendency to kind of normalize and kind of shut down and not to recognize the extraordinary character of the moment. And so, for those reasons, again, I really highly recommend your book, Transcendence. So we're going to have to wrap it up there. Is there a website or something you guys have for the book or for your own stuff?
Yes, okay. There is. There's transcendencethebook.net.
Excellent. Thanks a lot for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Thank you, Eric. Always fun to talk to you.
Thanks, Eric.
All right. From me and Majid, all you out there, keep your minds open.